This is Louisa Beale with Radio Tacoma. I'm talking with Dr. Helen Newman. She has a PhD in anatomy from the University of Washington and has the most amazing job. In fact, she may be the only one in the United States who does what she does. Dr. Newman, is this true?
Hello, Louisa. Yes, it is absolutely true. I started a veterinary tissue bank about 23 years ago now, and it was kind of an interesting story to bring us to the point where we are providing grafts for pets.
Yeah, so going from anatomy to tissue banking, it seems to me quite a leap.
Yeah, it was. It seems like at the time, you know, how you go down the road and you get a degree and then you think, what am I going to do with this degree? And I ended up doing a postdoctoral fellowship and thought, you know, I don't think I want to do research for the rest of my life. You know, what else can I do with this degree in anatomy? And then I got involved with the American Red Cross, and they had a tissue bank program down in Los Angeles, Orange County. And this was human tissue banking. So, you know, like when you sign your driver's license, whether you want to be an organ or tissue donor. So I got involved with that and did lectures at all the hospitals about organ and tissue donation. And then since my anatomy degree came in handy, I was involved with also doing the actual tissue recovery procedure. So I would talk with the donor families after we would get, say, a donor referral from a hospital in some tragic, difficult situation. I would talk with the families and they would give us consent to do tissue recoveries. And I'd pull a team together and we'd go to the hospital, schedule time in the OR and do tissue recovery procedures for, you know, human tissue mm-hmm. transplants. I did that for a couple of years in Los Angeles and then moved up here to the Puget Sound area, and the Puget Sound Blood Center had a very nice tissue bank at the time. It's since been sold, but I got involved with the tissue bank here and then spent 10 years involved with that.
Wow. Can I back up just a little bit? Because you talk about talking to the family about getting their approval for harvesting this tissue. What happens there? Are people resistant to this, or do they really feel like they are contributing?
You know, I always felt that people, honestly, you know, they're going through a very difficult time, and they know they're having to make an awful lot of decisions that they didn't plan on having to make that morning, you know, when they got up. Now they're in the middle of having to deal with a tragic situation. And when you get connected with them on the phone and talk with them about the option of organ and tissue donation, you know, what are their thoughts on organ and tissue donation? That just opens the door for them to say, oh, I didn't know that was possible. That would be something that I know my husband would really have liked to have done to help, you know, other people. And people are very altruistic in moments like this. Mm-hmm. Very often they are. You know, sometimes for some people, depending upon their feelings or perhaps their religion, you know, it may not permit something like that. But by and large, people feel some sense of relief come washing over them, some tiny positive thing is coming out of this, you know, knowing they can hang on to something that is going to help other people.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it was a difficult job, but it was also rewarding in the sense that you were giving people who were dealing with a really tragic situation something small, genuine, and positive.
So now you're doing this with animals.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we have much the same situation. I'll just take a couple of seconds and tell you about how I got the veterinary started.
Please.
So I had a technician who worked in my laboratory at the Puget Sound Blood Center, the tissue bank, and he had a dog with bad hips, so hip dysplasia. And of course, he spent his days making bone grafts, you know, for human surgeons to use. So he's like, I'm going to look up a veterinary surgeon who understands bone grafts. And because I know my dog's going to need, you know, some bone graft with his hip surgery. So he looked up Dr. Ken Sinibaldi, who's here in Seattle, and went to go see him. You know, Ken said, well, here's how we treat, you know, hip dysplasia. We make a cut in the bone and we put this wedge made of Teflon in there, and that changes how the bone sits in the hip socket, and that, you know, that fixes it. And Ted was, my technician, was taken aback. He's like, what? Why would you do that? Why wouldn't you use bone graft? You know, why would you put Teflon in, you know? And so, and Ken's eyes lit up and said, you know, I'm one of the only vets in the country who saves his own bone. And Ted said, well, I, you know, make bone grafts for humans. If I make a bone graft for my dog out of bone that you have saved, Dr. Sinibaldi, would you use it in my pet? And so anyway, Ted comes back to the lab with this little jar with a section of canine bone in it that Dr. Sinibaldi had recovered from one of his patients who had died. And of course, he had asked the owners if he could, you know, save some bone graft to help another animal. And so that's what got me interested. Ted came back with this jar with the bone in it and said, I need to use the hood. I have to make a bone graft for my dog. And I thought, I have got to go and talk to this Ken Sinibaldi.
Oh, wow.
And that Ken said, you have got to start a veterinary version of what you do at that human tissue bank, because we have dogs that get hit by cars. We got little dogs that get stepped on. We got dogs with bad hips, bad knees. You know, we need something like this. And so that was the light bulb moment for me.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And it's local.
We are located here in the Kent area, kind of right between Seattle and Tacoma. And we literally are the only one in the United States. And there's one other little one that started up in the UK.
Wow.
So to date, we supply grafts everywhere.
Wow. But then you need donors.
Right. And so we set up, you know, given my human tissue banking background, we set up a program that's very similar. So I go around to local veterinary hospitals and give talks, like a little lunch and learn or something like that, to the technicians and the doctors about our tissue banking program. And if they are interested in, at least they're informed about it, right? Mm-hmm. And if they're interested in becoming a donor partner hospital, we try to identify a person there who might just remember to keep this at the top of mind. You know, if a case that maybe meets our donor criteria comes through their door, and a family, you know, an owner of a pet maybe could benefit by hearing about this. And so we do kind of local education, and we work with local hospitals. We also work with some rescue groups as well, mm-hmm. to let people know that, you know, if a dog has to be put to sleep for some reason, like for aggression, for example, or gets hit by a car and dies in an emergency room setting, then those kinds of situations can transform into something where we can recover bone grafts and make those into grafts that can help other patients. So that's how the donor program works. With the hospitals, with veterinary, you know, people, because the decision for, say, a euthanasia is a very serious kind of thing. If, you know, someone loves a pet, oftentimes they, you know, they've struggled with, you know, training and behavioral training and medication and things like that. Or sometimes there are pets that have chronic medical conditions that, say, aren't infectious, but their quality of life for their pet, say they have a seizure disorder, mm-hmm. quality of life might be deteriorating, and they have to make some inevitable, you know, tragic decision. Right. It's nice that the hospital is prepared to be able to say something about tissue donation.
Yeah, because this is different, because when you did this with the human organ donation, you were able to talk to the family. And this way, mm-hmm. it's almost as if you have to have a go-between.
Right. And always in the hospital situation, there was a hospital staff person who connected us with the family, you know, who connected the tissue bank person on call, that would be me, mm-hmm. with the family, right? So there was always that kind of connection because and that's true here on the veterinary side, because this is a medical decision, right? And then we only step in to help and to do something after that, the decision for euthanasia, or after the death, you know, has occurred. And so there always is, you know, a veterinarian involved, and they're really helping to interact with the family and the patient. That's usually how it gets brought up. Mm-hmm. To a family. Sometimes with the rescue groups, that's a little bit of a different scenario. Okay. They are wonderful representatives of their breed. And of course, they want the all, you know, pets in their breed to have great homes, yeah. and to have the best chance at life, right? And turn them around if they've come from a difficult situation. And, you know, maybe there were challenges, but maybe they need a different scene, a different setting, you know, less triggers and things like that. And so I love it that they want their pets, their breed, to find good homes. But sometimes they just have very difficult decisions to make with, say, there's a serious bite history. Mm. And you know, a lot has been done to try to enable everyone to feel safe. And sometimes it's just unpredictable. And they may have to make a decision that it's, you know, given this bite history and all of the work that they've done, they can't assure that this dog might not, say, bite a child.
Right.
Then they're in a sort of a liable position, and they have to make a heart-wrenching decision to say, okay, well, this, we humanity has failed in this case, right? With
right.
this pet, with
right.
this dog, something in the breeding and the upbringing and the social situation and all the of its life, you know, led to an unpredictable behavior kind of ingrained. And then of course they feel bad about having to make a decision like that. But if they know about this, they can say, oh, this loss might be able to be turned into a positive.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what organs or tissues are donated? Is it just bone?
Right now, it's primarily bone grafts and tendons. You know, dogs, you know, a lot of humans have knee problems. Dogs also have cruciate ligament problems. They also have Achilles tendon ruptures, things like that. So we recover bone grafts and tendons, and sometimes we also recover corneas.
Oh, wow.
And those can be used to help dogs that, say, you know, have some kind of an ocular trauma or degenerative disease that involves just the clear cornea. Then some ophthalmologic surgeons can transplant the cornea and preserve the clear cornea and preserve, you know, the dog's vision that way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's primarily it. You know, veterinary medicine isn't quite as far along in terms of rejection medications and things like that as human medicine is in terms of organ transplant.
Right. So is that an issue? I mean, this is foreign material that's being, you know, transplanted into the pet. Are there rejection issues?
You know, that's a really great question. And a lot of people wonder about that. So, you know, with a heart or a liver or a kidney, of course there would be, right? Because we're saying, okay, this is Helen's liver, right? And it would say being transplanted into you, your body would go, hey, that's, you know, not my liver. And it would recognize it because there are living cells in my liver that, of course, make it function. And the cell surface markers on there, on those cells would say, hey, I'm Helen's liver. So, of course, your body would reject it. Whereas with things like bone grafts and tendons, those don't come with living cells in them. And in fact, our job as the tissue bank is to recover those and to process those in a way to remove the cells so that they don't stimulate a rejection response.
Yeah. And from what I understand, most of your samples are freeze-dried. Is that true?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. We can freeze dry the bone grafts, and so that puts them basically in a state of kind of suspended animation, and it preserves the proteins that help stimulate bone formation, and it prevents them from deteriorating because we've removed all the water by a special process. And so there's no way that they can deteriorate, you know, when they're freeze-dried and stored in a vacuum and things like that. Yeah, there's a, I don't know if you mind if I take 2 seconds to talk a little bit about bone graft. I guess, you know, my little scientist heart thinks that bone grafts, bone is a very amazing tissue in the sense that, you know, everybody knows it. Say you have a cut on your skin, right? You know, and it heals over. So there are stem cells there that come to the area and create new skin. And, you know, so with bone, what happens is bone creates growth factors, and it's the cells secrete that into the bone structure around themselves. And then the mineral lays down on top of these bone growth factors. And so the growth factors are kind of hidden beneath all of the mineral in your bone structure. So if, say, then you get a fracture, inflammation happens, and cells come in and resorb all the mineral, and that exposes the growth factors that were buried there. And those growth factors then stimulate the cells in the area to lay down new bone, because these are bone morphogenic proteins, they're called. So they stimulate the morphology of bone, basically. And so cells that come by there go, oh, this signal says I should be making bone. And so, and I just think it's the coolest thing that these little proteins are kind of hidden underneath the mineral. So when we process our bone graft, it doesn't require living cells for the bone to heal. It requires those little protein growth factors. And then the patient's own cells respond to those.
Wow.
And so when we freeze dry our bone grafts, it saves those proteins. And
oh, that's amazing.
It's pretty cool. But of course, you know, I'm excited about it.
It's extremely exciting. So is there a waiting list for recipients for these grafts?
Well, for some kinds of grafts, there are. And, you know, for some things that we, they're not very common. We make a lot of different kinds of grafts because veterinarians, of course, have all sorts of different needs. You know, they might need just some little kind of a little bit of bone powder, say you have a little dachshund and they have terrible teeth and you don't want to lose all their teeth, right? They have periodontic pockets and they've lost some bone. You might just need a little tiny bit of bone powder to put in around that tooth to save it. Mm-hmm. And we can make quite a bit of little doses of bone powder. But if someone has a dog that has a large tumor, for example, and they need to resect out or take out a large section of bone in order, say, to avoid amputation or something, then, you know, we may have to size match something, you know, to the forelimb of the donor and the recipient.
Yeah, okay.
So some things, they're, you know, people may have to wait a little bit for, but more common things we make and keep because we know every day we're going to be needing to send out grafts.
Sure. So it seems to me that there's certain donors that you're looking for. Are there some that you want to see and others that would be rejected as a donor?
Well, that's a really good question. We have some screening criteria for donors, and honestly, that's why I go around to the veterinary hospitals and give talks to, you know, the vet techs and the staff and the doctors there to talk a little bit about our donor screening. A general way to think about it is that if the dog has something that could be transplanted into another patient, then that would make them not a good donor. So if they have cancer, for example, right, or lymphoma or something like that, well, you know, we wouldn't want to take a graft from a patient that has a tumor that might spread to a recipient.
Sure.
Or some kind of infectious disease, you know, I mean, obviously, if they have something like rabies or parvo or things like that, you know, that could be transplanted. So we have kind of a list of exclusions like cancer. You know, recent exposure to things like rabies and parvo and things like that.
What about age? Can older dogs that just die of, quote, natural causes?
Well, we have sort of a soft upper age limit because, you know, a large breed dog, like say a Mastiff or something like that, you would say that's a geriatric dog if they were 8 years old, right? Mm-hmm. But an 8 year old lab is kind of prime of life. And so we might make different decisions, you know, based on that. But we generally say maximum age about 10 years old. As they get a little older than that, we worry about maybe there is an underlying condition that hasn't been diagnosed, things like that. That's our concern. Interestingly, with humans, you know, of course, everybody knows that people get osteoporosis and their bone graft, you know, their bone might not be as strong when you're older. But it took me a long time to realize that dogs actually don't suffer from osteoporosis. And so there isn't an upper age limit because of the bone quality, you know, or the bone being strong or not strong.
Okay.
It has to do with, you know, transmissible issues.
So do you have to register animals as donors? If I have a pet, would I have to register her in advance?
You know, the nice thing is that you don't have to register in advance. And this is something that can happen just even the same day if something tragic happens and it's a car accident. We wouldn't have to have any pet on a registry in order for them to become a tissue donor. So we don't actually set up a registry. And I think it might be difficult, you know, difficult to maintain and to manage. So it's just easiest if the referrals come through the veterinary clinics or the owner perhaps maybe brings up the thought with their veterinarian if their veterinarian doesn't bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
So they might say, isn't there something that could be done? Or I'm an organ and tissue donor on my driver's license. Is there any such thing for pets? Or I heard there was such a thing for pets and it's called, you know, veterinary transplant services.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is one way that actually we've had a number of donors because obviously I haven't been to every, you know, all sorts of veterinary clinics. And many times families will look up, you know, something because they know that it can be done for humans and they feel like, oh, if only something could be done for pets. And so people will sometimes find us, like pet owners will find us online and generally, you know, we guide them to work through their veterinarian and have their veterinarian give us a call because, you know, we'll want to get medical history information and things like that. And of course, we have to talk with the vet a little bit about the logistics, you know, how does this all work?
If you are just joining us, my guest is Dr. Helen Newman. She is the Director of Veterinary Transplant Services, which provides bone, soft tissue, and cornea grafts to help our pets. So it sounds like veterinarians really need to be educated about this.
Yes. You know, it's not an everyday thing that happens at vet clinics. And so not too much is different about the whole process. If a pet dies in the emergency room or it's a scheduled situation, a euthanasia situation for the reasons, you know, we talked about. The only thing different than the normal interaction with a veterinarian and the pet owner would be, the owners would sign a consent form. Saying, yes, we want this to happen. And we know VTS is going to collect grafts to help other animals. And I consent to that and the blood draw. And, you know, I agree to let VTS look at the medical records and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the veterinarian side, the only other thing is that we ask them to draw some blood for us. And they sign a form saying, you know, this is the veterinarian who was in attendance at the, you know, at the procedure and document, you mm-hmm. know, things like the time of death and, you know, general health of the animal at the time. And so the vet, you know, the extra things they have to do is pretty simple, you know, draw the blood and sign the form. But, you know, if they're unfamiliar with it, it might seem like, oh, one too many things to do, mm-hmm. you know, at a difficult time, because nobody wants to, you know, it's a very difficult time, no matter how it happens, you know,
yeah.
dealing with a family and a euthanasia and the loss of a pet.
Right.
You know, I encourage veterinarians or vet techs or, you know, front office staff who work at vet clinics to think about either contacting us if a case comes up or if they are familiar with it, you know, encourage them to bring it up with a family, because invariably families will say, I didn't know that was possible for pets. I had no idea. And like I was saying, for the human side, this light comes on for them, right? And nothing but dark was happening to them. You know, they're dealing with the loss of a pet. And by opening this door just a little bit, saying, you know, what are your thoughts on organ and tissue donation? And if the family says, I had no idea that was possible, then, you know, they've just stepped through that door, and you can say, well, we work with veterinary transplant services, and, you know, they can recover grafts. Would you like to learn more about it?
Right.
Right. And that kind of just starts the whole process. And it's simple steps, right? Consent, blood draw.
Well, yes. And, you know, in my days as a practicing veterinarian, you know, when it came time either for euthanasia or if an animal had died suddenly, we always talk about, well, what do you want to do with the body afterwards? I mean, because the options are, you know, group burial, private cremation, you know, with return of ashes. I mean, there's all these options. And it seems to me mm-hmm. that this is just allowing one more option for the owner.
Absolutely. And that you have pointed out the perfect time when this should be brought up, right? Because we don't want this to be an incentive for anybody, you know, to choose euthanasia. But once they are faced with that, right? Yes, the veterinary clinic has to talk with them about what do they want for aftercare, you know? Do they want a paw print? Do they want a fur clipping? Do they, you know, want a private cremation or general care of remains? And, you know, would they want their pet to become a tissue donor is an easy thing to add into that discussion.
Yeah. So then as far as if you do get the donor's body, mm-hmm. how do I phrase this? Do the owners get anything back, like any portion of ashes or a memorial or?
Yeah, from the owner's perspective, there really isn't any difference. So you are absolutely right. We would collect the donor's body and the blood samples and the medical records, and then we take them back to our facility where we can do the tissue recovery procedure. And we always ask, so what are the owner's wishes? You know, do they want a paw print? Do they want a fur clipping? You know, do they want a private cremation? And none of that is different. So all of that can still happen, even if their pet becomes a tissue donor. And then we will make sure that once we recover the bone grafts and the tendons and things, that if they want a general care, then that's the disposition and that's what happens. If they want to have the ashes back, then we will arrange for the cremation. Or now also we work with a company that does aquamation. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Oh yeah, that's like the recompose. Yeah.
Yes, it's there's, you know, recompose is actually a third way now, but aquamation is like cremation, but instead of heat, it uses liquid.
Wow.
And so you end up with ashes at the end, but it's a liquid process. And so many people kind of are just starting to hear about that and want to go with that because it's more carbon neutral. You know, it doesn't put all this heat into the atmosphere and things like that. And there is an innovative place in, I think they're in Renton, that has a facility that does this. So a couple of vet clinics that we work with, they always offer aquamation as an option. And so we've been there and talked with them and can send donor bodies there. So whatever the owners want.
Yeah. So you would just be one step along that process. It's like correct. You would harvest the tissue mm-hmm. before sending them on to the aquamation.
Right. Yes. And so, you know, the veterinary clinic kind of basically consigns their body to our care. We will, with much care, recover all of the grafts. And then we will do whatever the family wanted us to do with the pet's body. So, you know, sometimes they'll say, I want them to be cremated with their blanket.
Right.
You know, and we've done that, right? Or I would like them to be cremated with this collar and or this toy. And so those come along with the body, and we ensure that that happens. And then we will send the ashes back to the family once we get those back, if they choose a private cremation.
Right.
And then we do a few other things too, because I think it's important. To my way of thinking, I think, you know, we do a sort of a pay it forward thank you. We don't have any kind of a payment relationship with the veterinary hospitals that would refer a donor to us. This is an altruistic, we are trying to transform something tragic and difficult into something that helps other animals. And VTS is sort of the conduit that makes that happen. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want, you know, it's not a financial transaction whatsoever between us and the hospital where the patient is coming from. But as a thank you, in recognition of the hospital and also in honor of the donor, we work with Old Dog Haven.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if you're familiar with Old Dog Haven or your listeners are, but, you know, they take in old dogs, final refuge dogs, sometimes dogs that are abandoned at a vet clinic, and they're very old. They have medical problems. They just need love, right? You know, for the last few years of their life.
Right.
And of course, they pay for all their medical care. And so we make a donation to Old Dog Haven. And that helps support, you know, old dogs and their cause.
Oh, nice.
And, yeah. And then we've also recently joined up with the Arbor Day Foundation. And we also make a donation to the Arbor Day Foundation, which plants a tree in a national forest, you know, in recognition or in thanks. And I like that idea too, right? It's sort of giving back to the earth and creating something that grows. And so we do sort of a pay it forward kind of mm-hmm. thank you recognition to the hospitals and the families, you know, who choose this route.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. And so really your organization gets your, you know, funding from the sale of the tissue?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
So the veterinarians, yeah, who have patients who need a bone graft would pay for the bone graft, pay us for the bone graft.
Yeah.
And then we use that to cover the costs of maintaining, you know, this donor program and then all that we do to do the processing, because there's quite a lot of tissue testing that goes on to make sure that the grafts are safe. So in addition to just, you know, medical history, we do these blood tests and we do special nucleic acid tests, also called PCR tests, for all sorts of infectious, like mm-hmm. 30 different infectious diseases, you know, like rickettsias and ehrlichias and babesias,
yeah.
and things like that. And we archive samples and we do microbiology tests. So there's a lot that goes into, you know, the screening to make sure that when we go to process grafts, that the graft isn't going to transmit any diseases. And then when we process them, we have to make sure, of course, they meet all sorts of safety standards and that we didn't contaminate it and things like that.
Right.
So, and then of course we have to trace everything so that I can trace from the donor to the recipient through all of the steps of all the processing we do. So it's a pretty elaborate mm-hmm. process, you know, to assure safety and transparency about what happens and things like that.
Wow. Yeah. Whew. Well, it seems to me too, yeah, that, you know, you've got a lot of hurdles to go through before you actually get to, you know, a final freeze-dried sample.
And yes, absolutely.
And one of those seems to me to be where the donors can come from, because you couldn't get a donor from the other side of the country, you know, to have it shipped here in time before any degradation would happen.
Right. That's a very good question. And that is one of our challenges, is that there are times when I am worried that maybe we don't have enough donors because there is an awful lot of need. And the more that people hear about, oh, you mean my dog doesn't have to lose all their teeth if they get a bone graft, you know, and the more veterinary dentists say, hear about it, you know, more and more people are realizing the benefit of being able to use a bone graft in a fracture repair, or like I was saying, this dentistry. And so of course the demand is going up as people hear about the benefits of it. Mm-hmm. And then of course we, as you point out, can really only recover grafts from donors in this Washington state area.
Yeah.
So sometimes we don't have enough donors.
Yeah, it would seem. Is there a certain mileage where you can, that's your kind of your outlying area where you can actually get a donor?
Gosh, we've had some donors even out of Oregon, and sometimes we've met people partway, you know, or we've driven all the way down there. But normally, it's in this like Seattle, Western Washington area, mm-hmm. All the way from, you know, Everett on down to Olympia, and you know, out to the mountains,
yeah,
over to the peninsula. So, you know, we've had some donors from over in the Olympic Peninsula. So we will drive quite a long way,
yeah,
to make this happen, right?
But then it seems to me, too, that your donor, your processed material, the freeze-dried tissue, can be sent anywhere.
Yeah, so that's the beauty of the freeze drying, is that once it's freeze dried, it can be stored at room temperature. So then, and it has a very, you know, it's like 5 years of shelf life or more. So we can then ship it to England or Switzerland, mm-hmm. or, you know, there's a veterinary dental specialist in Finland who uses a lot of our bone graft for her pets there, and she's got quite a reputation, so she sees some very difficult cases, mm-hmm. and so we our grafts go to Italy, we have some of our grafts go to Australia, go to Hong Kong. I mean, we have grafts and veterinarians and patients all over.
Oh wow, that's astounding.
Yeah, yeah. It's you know, it's, when you think about it, it is, you know, it's a small local program, but it really has a worldwide touch to pets and pet owners. And I know that it makes a difference. It's been interesting. I don't know if you mind me telling you one or two stories here. But
I was just going to ask. Yes, please.
Well, early on, I had a veterinarian called me back after we had sent a bone graft, a big section of bone for a dog that had cancer. And the veterinarian called me back a couple of months later and said, you know, that patient I did, he's doing so well. And at the last visit, the family wanted to know if the donor was a greyhound. And I said, well, I can look that up for you. And they said, because our dog is running around the backyard like you would not believe. Like, he's just pain-free, and he's running and running. And I thought, you know, that's what this is supposed to be all about, right? I think the question was a little facetious about, was it a greyhound? It was just kind of a way of giving you feedback about, wow, the spirit, right, of this other pet is living on and enjoying life, running around.
Right.
So there's things like that. Yeah. Or a veterinarian I was just talking with last week, you know, we were talking about bone grafts, and he had a really challenging case, and we got to talking, and he said, you know, you have got to keep doing what you're doing because you do such meaningful work. And I just said, you know, you're making my day, because my day is, you know, we're working, we do paperwork, of course, but we're working on the challenging side, right? On the sad side, on the families that are dealing with these losses. And then we make all of these graphs, but we aren't the ones that are seeing the patients that have the wagging tails and are going out and running around the, you know, running around the yard. So it's so nice to get feedback from vets. And I love it when they send us x-rays or follow-ups, especially of some of those really difficult cases.
Oh, yeah.
And so,
yeah. Yeah, well, that's, gosh, I understand about this because a lot of times, you do something to help an animal, and oftentimes you never hear about it unless it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So to get that kind of feedback is so heartwarming, and it does make it all worthwhile.
Yeah, it really makes you understand that there is a whole circle here, right? And it ends up, starts out with a patient and it ends up with a patient. And, we are just doing what we can in the middle to make that happen.
Yeah, you're doing really, really good work.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, I appreciate you saying that. And, the way I sort of see this is, you know, I'm a scientist kind of trying to run a business and get things started, right, and make this happen. But I'm really not very good at kind of getting the word out. And when I start talking with people, they're like, that is so amazing that you do what you do. And, I'm just so pleased to be able to share this with you, right, because then more people will hear about the kinds of things that are possible for pets.
Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah.
So it seems to me that if people want more information, they could contact you. But if they want to actually enroll in the program, they should contact their veterinarian.
Yeah, at the time, yes. Or they can even at a normal health check, if the inevitable happens at some point, I am interested in veterinary tissue donation. And then it would become part of that patient's record. And maybe the veterinarian, if they're not, haven't heard from us before, would call us. And of course we have brochures and, we have information that we can send to vet clinics or to families.
Okay. So if someone wanted to contact you directly, would they be able to do that?
Well, yes, because our information is out there. They could definitely find us. I'm just wouldn't encourage.
Okay, then I'm not going to give any contact information.
Yeah, I think if it's a situation that's come up and they're dealing with their pet, losing their pet, then they should be contacting their veterinarian. I'll say here's a reason why I'm hesitant. Sometimes I got a call from a woman who found us on the internet who said she had this big dog and he was big and hairy and drooly, and she was now pregnant and she was going to have this baby, and the dog was anxious and she just couldn't see taking the dog to the animal shelter. They couldn't have the dog around because he was drooly and she was pregnant. And she couldn't take him to the animal shelter because she thought he'd be too terrified, so she was going to euthanize him, and she'd feel so much better if he could become a donor. And I just was a little mortified by that.
Yeah.
Because no one was involved other than that, he was hairy and drooly, and that was going to be the reason he was euthanized. And so he was part of a special, he was a part breed of one of the rescue groups that we worked with. And I said, let me just try to help you a little bit. And I called the breed rep and I said, I know this isn't a pure breed dog, but can you help me help this person find a home for her dog who needs to be on a ranch outdoors somewhere,
Oh, good for you.
So she did help, and she found a home. And so this big hairy yellow drooly dog is now probably running around on a ranch in Montana somewhere. Right. I'm trying to avoid being the convenient reason to euthanize a dog,
right,
if you know what I mean.
Right. Exactly.
So that's why I think, for a number of reasons, but that being one of them, vets should be the primary contactor.
Yeah.
But of course there's information out there on the web about us, and they could find us
if they really wanted to.
Yeah.
But then you'll direct them in the right way.
Yeah, and we'll give them a little information and we'll talk to them about what is their situation. And, you know, like this feed cat donor, it was all very, you know, legitimate. This cat, you know, had a, I think it wasn't a, I don't know, I can't remember what the condition was for this cat, but this was a foregone conclusion that this cat would not survive. So that was a different situation altogether, right?
Yeah. Wow. Well, this has just been an amazing, amazing conversation. Thank you so much.
Oh, I so much appreciate talking with you. It's a wonderful thing that you do, and I appreciate you kind of shedding light on what it is that we do. I'm actually kind of interested in seeing the other people that you interview and what you do with your show. So it's nice to make your acquaintance and
yes.
get involved.
So good to meet you too.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Louisa.
Thank you. You've been listening to A Conversation with Dr. Helen Newman. She is the Director of Veterinary Transplant Services, which provide bone, soft tissue, and cornea grafts to help our pets. If you are interested in their services, please contact your veterinarian. This is Louisa Beal with Radio Tacoma.